May it please the court, Carrie Atencio, bar number 29966, on behalf of the plaintiff appellants, Malaga LLC and Edson Hutchinson. The district court erred in dismissing the claims against Charter Oak, American Guarantee and Liability, and Colorado West on the ground that Charter Oak's insurance policy did not, quote, cover, close quote, the claims in the underlying case. Among many of the patent errors, the district court's first was that it failed to appreciate that the claims against Colorado West were in fact based on a failure to defend Malaga, which will include, unless I say otherwise, both Mr. Hutchinson and the entity. Because of that, the district court didn't in fact actually conduct a duty to defend analysis. In fact, the words duty to defend do not appear anywhere in the court's October 5th, 2011 order that's being appealed from. The district court did not cite a single appellate authority that deals with the duty to defend, but of course that's what the claims were based on against Charter Oak. That's what the summary judgment briefs were based on, and that's what the district court should have done. The district court, of course, should have known that the duty to defend is well established in Colorado. It is a very broad duty and established in cases like Heckler and Cypress AMAX. It's a very high burden to meet if the insurance company like Charter Oak here wants to avoid its duty to defend. All that the insured has to do is show that there is a single claim, a single solitary claim that is arguably made out by the facts that are alleged in the pleadings. And those are the actual facts, not hyperbole, not rhetoric, not conclusory statements that are alleged in the pleadings.
Ms. Atencio, let me interrupt you, and I'm sorry, but I need to ask you a question here. Wasn't the trial court's order and the language regarding coverage or coverage for liability under the policy, didn't it impliedly encompass the duty to defend?
It perhaps did, but the court did not in fact conduct the correct analysis because it did not look for specific facts that were alleged in the pleadings to find if there were the elements of an arguably covered claim, either under the coverage A, property damage, or coverage B, personal injury coverage. Instead, it was looking at essentially the merits of the claim, of the claims, instead of looking about, again, whether there were specific facts that were alleged. And in fact, when you do look at the facts as opposed to the hyperbole and the rhetoric and all the conclusory statements that are in those pleadings, there are in fact three claims that are arguably pleaded in the complaint, the corrected amended complaint, and the second amended complaint. There are first under the coverage A, the property damage coverage. That can be either by physical injury to tangible property or by loss of use of tangible property that is not physically injured. First of all, we do have...
Let me stop you there. Property damage is required under coverage A, correct?
That's correct.
You argue property damage could occur by physical injury or loss of use. You just said that. That's the definition of property damage, right?
Correct.
Doesn't there have to be an occurrence, whether it be physical injury or loss of use? There has to be an occurrence, is there not?
There does, Your Honor, and that's in fact one thing that the district court missed.
Okay, nonetheless, there has to be an occurrence under the policy. So, what was the occurrence here that constitutes an occurrence, I think is defined as an accident, if I'm not mistaken, and under our law we know what an accident, what was the occurrence that triggered the claim for physical injury?
As Your Honor just pointed out, the policy only defines occurrence as a quote-unquote accident, but accident is not further defined in the policy. Therefore, we can turn to the plain and ordinary meaning of that term, and Charter Oak agreed that that ought to be an unintended or unusual result flowing from a commonplace cause. Mm-hmm. So what you need to do is analyze whether any of the physical injury property damage, I believe that's what Your Honor just asked about specifically, whether there was any of that physical injury to the property was the result of or was caused by a something that was the unusual or unanticipated result of commonplace cause. So what you look at is the parking of the cars. And the physical injury, in that case, when we're talking about the old Vine parking spaces as opposed to the easement spaces. So the commonplace cause is the parking of the cars. Was physical injury to the ground, which can be inferred, which is inferred by the law, to incur when you've got a physical trespass like you do in this situation where you've got cars parking on the ground.
Where does that incur in the law?
Under the Van Wyck case that we cited.
Van Wyck involves an intangible intrusion. Electromagnetic waves came over there properly, or maybe noise, I'm not sure which. This was not an intangible intrusion, as you described, cars were parked in the space. That's a physical intrusion.
It was implied by the court's holding, Your Honor. The motion to dismiss was upheld by the Supreme Court on the ground that the plaintiff in that case had not, in fact, alleged any physical damage to have resulted from the intangible intrusion. But then the court went on to say, nor did the plaintiff allege a physical intrusion onto the property. So the implication is if you've got a physical injury or a physical trespass to the property, then you are going to infer that there was, in fact, physical damage to the property, even if on a nominal basis. In the Proper versus French case that are discussed in both Charter's briefs, as well as ours, also would support that.
So you're asking us to interpret Old Vine's claims as if they alleged a trespass, even though the word trespass is never used in the complaint. You're asking us to infer from the inferred trespass claim that there was also a physical injury, even though no physical injury is alleged in the Old Vine complaint against Milan. That's basically what you're asking us to do here.
Your Honor, it's actually a little bit incorrect. The word trespass is, in fact, used in the complaints in the case. And they do talk about those the trespasses to the property being one of the reasons that they were being harmed in that case, in the underlying situation.
But there is no allegation of physical injury in the Old Vine complaint.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but because you can imply that under the law, that there's going to be physical injury, and what you're doing is you're looking for the elements of any potentially covered claim under any of the coverage provisions. So you can infer, because you can infer physical injury, by law, you can infer that that was also pleaded in the complaints. But we don't even need to do that. We don't need to base the coverage decision or the duty to defend on a physical injury, because there was also loss of use very clearly pleaded in the operative pleadings there. There were allegations, of course, naturally, when you've got the parking spaces being used by Malaga, Mr. Hutchinson, or hotel guests, you're going to lose the ability to make use of those spaces yourself.
All right, but I guess I don't understand then what the accident was. The accident was, this was not an accident, this was an intentional conduct on the part of Old Vine, or at least directed conduct, to allow the customers of the hotel to park in the either Old Vine spaces or the 62 easement spaces.
Again, you've got to go back to the definition of occurrence, which is an unintended or unusual result flowing from a commonplace cause. The commonplace cause is going to be the parking of vehicles. And is a trespass going to be an unusual or unanticipated result of parking cars in a normal parking space, from either Malaga's perspective or from the hotel guest's perspective? And there's certainly no allegations in the pleadings that the hotel guests understood that they were trespassing on anybody's property.
But Malaga understood that they were allowing them to park in these places. It sounds like not an accident. Well, as Judge Hoffman found, not an accident.
The allegations respecting Mr. Hutchinson's and Malaga's intent or state of mind are nothing more than conclusory statements, and they ought not to be relied on by the insurance company in determining the duty to defend. And in fact, the actual easement agreement that was attached to the pleadings in the underlying case showed, and in fact the pleadings alleged, that Mr. Hutchinson declared that the easement agreement had been terminated because of Old Vine failing to uphold their end of the agreement, which was paying rent for those spaces. So the pleadings do in fact allow for a finding that Mr. Hutchinson and or Malaga in fact believed that that agreement had been validly terminated. And if it had, then Old Vine did not have a right to be using those spaces, and therefore Malaga would not be intending or expecting to cause harm by either affirmatively parking their own vehicles on there or allowing hotel guests, in other words, not stopping them in some way beforehand. So we don't need to rely on the inference of physical injury in order to find that there were arguably covered claims under the property damage coverage of the charter oak policy. And even if we didn't have at least three of those property damage claims that are alleged in the pleadings, we have the personal injury coverage as well that was arguably pleaded, a claim for wrongful entry onto premises that were being occupied by Old Vine by or on behalf of the owner, which was Malaga, and the wrongful entry being accomplished by Malaga.
Which spaces does that theory apply to?
Only the easement spaces, because the personal injury coverage applies to property that essentially the owner of is interfering with the rights of someone else.
So how did Old Vine occupy spaces that were, they weren't occupied in the common sense. Nobody was there except when the cars were parked there.
Well, you have to go back to the plain language of the policy, and the term occupy is, again, not defined by the policy. Under Black's Law Dictionary, that can be to use, to hold, or to do business in, and that's exactly what Old Vine was using those spaces for. They were attempting to use them, and in fact, I think the allegations support that they were using them from time to time when they were available for the purpose of trying to conduct business.
Well, they had a non-exclusive right to park there, correct?
That is correct.
You and I have a non-exclusive right to park on Lincoln Street, but you don't think you have an occupancy right there, do you?
Well, again, there is nothing in the case law that supports Charter Oak's position that there has to be some sole and exclusive right to possession in order to have a right, in order to constitute a wrongful entry, in order to occupy for the party to be occupying those premises. And in fact, the Rockgate case cited by Charter Oak and relied on in their answer brief actually supports that as well. It says in that case they were dealing with some parties who were trying to rent a hotel room and they were not allowed to do that, and so there was an issue about whether there was a wrongful entry claim or personal injury coverage in that case. And the court said all that they would need to do in order to possess that hotel room was just to be physically present there. So even though they're not constantly occupying those spaces, they are making use of them from time to time, and when they do that, they are occupying them.
Following Judge Webb's suggestion, why don't you turn to the negligence claims against Colorado West?
Thank you, Your Honor. District Court fundamentally misunderstood what the basis of Malaga's claims were against Colorado West, and for that reason, the District Court erred when it dismissed the claim, actually as a single claim for negligence against Colorado West, on the grounds that the Charter Oak policy did not provide coverage. The theory of negligence against Colorado West is that its failure to provide notice, first of all, to Mountain States, which was the previous insurer, by doing that, by failing to give them notice, Malaga was forced to incur and spend its own money out of its own pocket to defend the case, the underlying case.
Let me stop you for a second. Judge Hoffman dismissed the claims against Colorado West, as I understand, on the basis that no coverage under the old Charter Oak policy meant no coverage under the Merit Guarantee policy, therefore the negligence claims and the failure to transmit the claims doesn't make any difference. But did he fail to address the claim that he noticed the amount of mistakes?
He did, yes,
Your Honor. It appears to me from his opinion that he did not specifically address that. Is the claim relating to the failure to transmit notice to Mountain States different from the claim relating to failure to transmit notice to American Guarantee?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, because Mountain States actually stepped up at the last minute before trial, said, yes, we will agree to defend you in this case. And they did provide an attorney, although they declined to cover any of the pre-tender costs and essentially refused to pay for any of the costs of the attorney that had been handling the case and would be trying the case.
Is the Mountain States policy providing the same coverage that the Charter Oak and the American Guarantee policy were providing, essentially? In other words, if we find against you on the coverage under Charter Oak, does Judge Hoffman's rationale still apply?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because regardless of what the district court's going to do, in hindsight, essentially, Mountain States was entitled to, and it did make a decision under its policy, that it was going to find that there had been at least one arguably covered claim that was pleaded, and as a result, it was going to provide a defense.
Under reservation of rights.
Under reservation of rights.
So it stepped up, it provided a defense. At some point, it actually contributed to the settlement. Your damages, your client's damage, would be the cost of defense up to the point it appeared. Is that right?
That is part of it. We would also be claiming as damages against Colorado West based on a DC-10 case that was recently issued, the damages that were established by Judge Briggs in the subsequent mediation or arbitration would also be something that Colorado West could be responsible for.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's John Chase on behalf of Charter Oak Fire Insurance Company. As a matter of housekeeping, I'm going to speak to coverage under the Charter Oak policy and therefore the basis for Judge Hoffman's ruling. I'm going to leave time for my colleagues to speak. In particular, Mr. Arguello is going to speak to the Colorado West issues. That is his client. Bar number is 30820.
May we assume that your coverage analysis would have equal application to American Guarantee?
I believe so, with one potential exception, which counsel for American Guarantee will probably speak to. She requested about 2 minutes to address one issue particular to her client.
Thank you.
This case can be summed up in three pretty simple statements. Allegations of a fraudulent scheme, whether real or imagined, don't allege an accident. Number two, impaired marketability and lost profits resulting from that scheme don't constitute property damage under a CGL policy, commercial general liability policy. And number three, the unanimous case law from around the country holds that violation of an easement agreement does not trigger personal injury coverage under a CGL. And I'd like to speak to each of those issues individually. With respect to the issue of whether an occurrence was alleged in the underlying complaints, in our brief, Charter Oak's answer brief on page 24, we actually cite from Malaga's complaint against Charter Oak in this case. They summed up the essence of the underlying allegations, and in doing so, Malaga itself says, in essence, Olvine alleged in the second amended complaint that Malaga wanted to obtain the Olvine property for itself, and in an effort to do so, carried out various wrongful actions consistent with this goal over a year and a half period of time. And we agree with that. And I believe Judge Richmond hit the nail on the head when he asked, where is the accident here?
And counsel said there was an accident from parking the cars in the lot and the spaces, and I guess you said incidentally causing property damage.
Why is that not an accident?
First of all, she said that might be true.
It was paraphrasing.
Yes, of course. I heard the argument, and she said, with respect to, or from the standpoint of the guest, it might be accidental conduct. It doesn't matter. We don't insure the guest. With respect to Malaga and or Mr. Hutchinson, the principal who directed this so-called scheme, in July of 2007, before the Charter Oak policy ever began, he was told by his neighboring landowner, your folks are parking in my lot and they shouldn't be doing it. He declined, and we addressed this in our brief, and this is documented in the exhibits to the underlying complaint. He declined to address their concerns until they paid him the money he claimed was owed on the easement, including back pay to maintain the easement while the building sat vacant and was not in use. And so whatever might be said about his knowledge or intent before he was put on notice by Old Vine that there was a problem, you can't say that there was an accident as of the time he was directing this conduct during the Charter Oak policy period. And as for the damages element of this complaint, which you have to have property damage in some form, I'm not willing to accept that parking in parking spaces causes damage to property. That's what they're designed to accommodate.
Right. I think what counsel says, we're supposed to infer property damage from the allegations of trespass under the reverse, like 180 of the Van Wyck case.
That's not what the Van Wyck case says.
No, I know the Van Wyck case doesn't say that, but she suggests we're supposed to infer it.
Actually, I believe the Van Wyck case supports our position that where you have what you described as an intangible trespass, noise, sound, in the case of Van Wyck.
Intangible intrusion.
Intangible intrusion without allegations of physical injury, no tort for trespass will lie. But that is not the same as saying if you have a tangible trespass, you have property damage. Mm-hmm. The trespass is complete irrespective of whether there's any damage by virtue of the fact that you have physical intrusion onto someone else's property. Mm-hmm. And so the two are not the reverse of
so that. A trespass claim could certainly exist without physical damage to property. If someone walks across your lawn and doesn't do anything, but they bend the grass, that's still a trespass, but there's no real physical damage. But you can get nominal damages for that.
I agree. According to Colorado law, that's what the jury instruction requires.
But the nominal damages are not indicative of physical injury, would be your position.
I agree. Nor would, I think, this trespass result in a loss of use. I mean, with respect to the parking structure itself, I don't think there can be any legitimate argument that Malaga trespassed on its own property, which it owned, subject to an easement, and thereby caused a loss of use of the adjacent building. With respect to the parking spaces that were owned by Old Vine, the lawsuit wasn't about a loss of use of those spaces. The lawsuit was about the fact that as a result of this scheme concocted by Malaga to exert financial pressure on Old Vine and cause them to sell out cheaply or pay an exorbitant rate for their easement rights, Old Vine was unable to market and sell their property, which they bought as investment property. And I don't want to belabor the facts, but they're set forth in our brief, and Judge Hoffman did a duty to defend analysis. And while he may not have cited the case law we cited to him, he addressed the issue of whether there was an accident, and he found there was no accident. And he also addressed the issue of whether there was damage that would be covered property damage under a CGL policy, and he found that wasn't the case either. And then he addressed the issue of coverage under coverage B.
Personal injury coverage.
Right.
And you say violation of, in many cases, I think you said, that a violation of an easement is not personal injury.
There is no Colorado case on point. All of the cases we found and cited to the court from around the country are unanimous in holding that absent a possessory interest in land, you cannot have a wrongful eviction or violation of a right of private occupancy. And Colorado case law is clear that an easement does not convey a possessory interest in land. And therefore, for the court to hold that a personal injury claim was alleged, you would have to create new law, not only in Colorado, but disregard all of the other law from around the country on the subject. The Rockgate case does not stand for the proposition that counsel cited it for. To the contrary, we believe it supports our position that absent a possessory interest in land, you do not have a personal injury claim. Also, let's not forget, and I do want to step down because my colleague's there today, with respect to these issues of occurrence, property damage, and or with respect to coverage B, personal injury coverage. First, you have to show that coverage was triggered, but even if coverage was triggered, coverage might yet be excluded. And we believe that if the court were inclined to find coverage was triggered in the first instance, there are two exclusions cited under coverage A, the intended damages exclusion, as well as the impaired property exclusion that would clearly apply if there was an occurrence resulting in property damage. And under coverage B, there is also an exclusion that would apply. And in fact, I believe Judge Hoffman did find that that exclusion applied on these facts. So unless there are any other questions regarding his order, I'm going to reserve the remaining time for my colleagues. Thank you.
Good morning. Christy Boonhart, 24479, on behalf of American Guarantee Insurance. Just quite briefly, because we do want to reserve time, we have adopted the same arguments on coverage as Charter Oak. There's just one difference. By the time that American Guarantee had learned of this lawsuit, first of all, it was settled, but at that time, there was a fax that was given on April 30th. It did not get processed until the beginning of May. But at that time, there was only one claim remaining in this case, and that was a breach of a parking easement claim. And there was an April 19th order by the trial court that had said, in regard to that claim, typically discussing interference with property, typically there's some physical obstruction prevented the dominant estate from accessing or utilizing the easement. That was not the case in the underlying matter. Defendants have not blocked access to the spaces, nor have they prevented plaintiff from utilizing the spaces on the property. In fact, plaintiff conceded in its reply brief on its motion to amend the complaint that this is not a case about trespass. This, for these reasons, the court then found that the breach of parking easement claim is based in contract.
Are you talking about that's in the old line case?
In the underlying case, okay. That was the order at the time that American Guarantee that was existing, there was only one claim that was left. And so there was not a trespass claim remaining, it was only a breach of contract. That is not something that alleges an occurrence, it's not an accident, and it would be something that would be excluded under the policy.
So at the time American Guarantee was notified, the only remaining claim was a contract claim?
Correct.
Okay, got it.
And that's all I have, unless you have further questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Run the podium down if you wish.
May it please the court, Damian Arguello, registration number 35719, for Appley and Cross Appellant, Colorado West. Summary judgment in favor of Colorado West should be affirmed for two principal reasons. First, there's no proximate causation because none of Malaga's policies provided coverage for the underlying lawsuit. Second, Malaga's insurers were bound by notice to Colorado West because Colorado West was their agent. With respect to lack of coverage under Malaga's policies, the counsel for Charter Oak has already laid out strong arguments as to why there was no coverage under that policy. Malaga argued in the underlying court, in the district court, that the policies were essentially identical, and Colorado West made that same argument. And so therefore, if there's no coverage on the Charter Oak policy, there's no coverage under any of the policies.
Right, but as Mr. Tensley just laid out, the claim in against Colorado West to the extent it involves failure to give notice to Mountain West is a different claim. It's a different, it's a claim of a different nature. Why don't you address that argument?
Absolutely. Yes, as for Mountain States, it did step up and provide a limited defense under a full reservation of rights. That is the right to deny coverage. That was essentially a gratuitous payment that Mountain States Mutual made. And just because they made that payment having received notice on the eve of trial doesn't mean that they would have made that same payment had they received notice earlier. That's entirely speculative.
Isn't that a fact issue that renders summary judgment inappropriate and would have to be resolved by the jury, perhaps based on expert testimony?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but if Milaga wanted to survive summary judgment on this basis, it should have presented some sort of evidence that Mountain States would have made such a payment.
But wasn't the fact that they did make the payment at least some evidence that they would have made the payment had they been notified earlier?
It is evidence that may support an assumption, but it doesn't support a fact conclusion, certainly, that would survive summary judgment.
You're saying because Mountain States paid $250,000 wouldn't permit a reasonable jury to infer that they might have stepped up and defended the claim from the onset if they got timely notice?
It may. That is a possibility. But as a matter of law, I think it is bad policy to hold Colorado West liable for a speculative, gratuitous payment that Mountain States made. And I'll give you an analogy that may make it a little bit more clear. Let's assume Colorado West is a travel agent and had procured for Milaga a timeshare condo in the Caribbean. The first time Milaga wanted to use the condo, they notified Colorado West that they wanted to do so. Colorado West informs the owner. Milaga travels to there, and instead of getting the small condo that they contracted for, they get a beach bungalow. Just a gratuity, something token of thanks from the owner. The next time that they want to rent the condo, Colorado West forgets to notify the owner. Milaga's out of luck, can't go, can't use the timeshare. Milaga's only entitled to what they contracted for, the benefit that they contracted for. They're not entitled to the gratuitous beach bungalow. They're only entitled to the condo. Here, Mountain States did not legally have a duty to defend or indemnify under their policy. The fact that they gratuitously offered that is a great benefit for Milaga, but they're not entitled to that in terms of damages for negligence on Colorado West part, if there was any.
So isn't another permissible inference for a reasonable jury to draw that in the view of Mountain States, the coverage question was simply gray enough that to mitigate their risk, they would have defended? I mean, insurance companies, like most businesses, just don't gratuitously give away money.
Right. It may be a permissible inference for the jury to draw that Mountain States saw some exposure and out of conjecture decided that they were going to resolve this case in the way that they did.
Doesn't that mean then that your proximate cause argument is something that should be addressed to the jury?
Possibly, Your Honor, but I would say again, as a matter of law, Colorado West isn't liable for speculative gratuitous payments. They're only liable for what the policy provided for, if they're liable at all.
You also argue that there's the notice to the Colorado West is notice to the insurer. I think that's what you said earlier.
Correct.
So you say in your brief. Would you address that issue?
Absolutely.
And how that resolves the claim that Milaga is making vis-a-vis lack of notice to Mountain States?
Correct, Your Honor. Under CRS 10-2-4-0-1-1, which I'll refer to just simply as the statute basically abandoned the traditional agent-broker distinction that existed prior to 1993. And in the licensing scheme, there's now only a single insurance producer. And the General Assembly, for reasons that aren't exactly clear in the statute, determined that the producer represents the insurance company and not the insurer in any controversy surrounding the policy that it places. And this tracks basic Hornbook agency law. A principal is bound by the knowledge and conduct of its agent.
Okay, but the Mountain States policy had an I assume, I haven't read it, has an express provision in saying you got to give us notice of the claim.
Correct.
Whatever the general law is about agency. So
correct.
How is that satisfied by giving notice to Colorado?
Well, as you pointed out, the policy does have a duty to the insured, on the insured, to provide notice to its insurance companies. So if you're thinking about it, in one sense, Milaga is attempting to transfer that duty to an agent of the other side of the contract, to the insurance company. So that's a real question as to whether they can even do that. But stepping away from that, an insurance company as a corporation can only act through its agents. It is not an individual, so it has to act through its agents. This was its sales force, this was its distribution force, and Milaga clearly believed that Colorado West had the ability to accept such notices.
So in other words, Mountain States would have had a defense. They would have had a defense, excuse me, Milaga would have had a response to Mountain States' denial of coverage if they said, we deny coverage for lack of notice. Their response would have been, we gave notice to Colorado West, and therefore Milaga would have had a response to Mountain States. But that doesn't seem to be the issue. The issue here is, while notice to Colorado West may constitute notice to Mountain States, did Colorado West discharge a duty that it had to Milaga to pass that notice on to Mountain States?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that the only duty that Colorado West had with respect to notice is to submit that notice to its principals, the insurance companies, and in particular here, Mountain States. Now, Mountain States...
And it's alleged that it didn't do that.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so that's the negligence they allege.
Well, perhaps Colorado West may have breached a duty that it had to Mountain States or to American Guarantee in this situation, but that breach of a duty to its principal does not create a duty or negligence claim for a third party.
Is there evidence in the record that Colorado West told Milaga that it was going to pass the Charter Oak notice on to Charter Oak?
I believe there is, Your Honor. I believe that I don't know if they were that clear that they said they were going to pass notice on to Charter Oak, but they informed Milaga that they had done so virtually immediately.
Okay, well, from that, couldn't Milaga reasonably assume that Colorado West would do the same thing with the notice of a claim under the Mountain States policy?
Perhaps it could assume that Colorado West would have done so. I'm not sure that it would have been reasonable for them
Why not? I mean, if they pass on, if they said essentially they were the procuring agent for two policies, and they tell the insured we're going to pass the notice on to insurer A, why isn't it reasonable for the insured to say, okay, I assume you're going to pass on the notice to insurer B?
I would think that the better argument, the one that Milaga should have made, was when they got reservation of rights from Mountain States and from American Guarantee, that reference late notice, they should have said, no. You were notified when we notified Colorado West. They're your agent. You're bound by that. Therefore, you can't raise late notice.
Well,
that
wouldn't have made any difference as to Mountain States. They already came in and they paid. The question is the cost of defense up to the time they came in. That's the issue that I think we're dealing with here. Those are the damages.
Right, and I would have argued if I were in Milaga's position that they could have denied coverage for pre-tender defense costs precisely because they were technically and legally on notice.
Okay. Counsel, your time's about up, but I want to, if we can give you a couple more minutes, Your Honors, would you address the cross appeal with respect to the taking of the depositions of counsel for Milaga?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the district court erred in denying Colorado West's motion to compel those depositions because the district court focused and held that it was Colorado West that brought this protected information and put it at issue. Our reading of the law here in Colorado is that the at-issue waiver is not so narrow. That basically a plaintiff, when it brings a negligence claim, puts at issue any information relevant to proximate causation and damages. So it was Milaga, not Colorado West, that put this information at issue.
Okay, let me ask some questions here. You say that Mr. Dietrich, the prior counsel, had copies of all three of Milaga's policies, but that's undisputed in the record, correct?
Correct.
And then it's also undisputed that he did not give notice to Mountain States while he had possession of the policies, correct?
Correct.
And it's also undisputed that he turned all the policies over to the successor law firm that came in to represent Malott, correct?
Well, I don't think it's undisputed that all the policies were submitted. I think it's unclear in the record that's been developed so far which policies were transferred to Malott's current counsel.
Some policies were transferred to Malott's current counsel.
Correct.
And Mr. Dietrich did not testify that all the policies were transferred?
No, I believe he testified that he wasn't sure exactly which policies were transferred at the time of his deposition.
Well, in any event, I mean, why do you need Mr. Levine's deposition since Mr. Dietrich had the policies? He's the agent of his client, and if there was a duty to give notice, the duty would have ripened while he had the policies.
Well, I think in part, as Malott has pointed out, we did not designate Malott's current counsel as a non-party at fault. We don't know exactly what they did with those policies. We don't know the scope of their representation of Malott, whether they were charged with gathering policies and giving any notices. There are just a lot of unanswered questions that may or may not lead to Malott's counsel being disqualified at trial.
Well, let me back up. You took Mr. Dietrich's deposition, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so then if there's any unanswered questions, isn't that your problem?
Well, no, Your Honor, we would submit that as a defendant charged with negligence, that we have the right to gather all relevant information that concerns proximate causation and damages. You know, the other aspect of this, and I know this runs somewhat counter to the DC 10 Manor Insurance case, but we believe that the case law supports not holding Colorado West, not binding Colorado West with the underlying settlements with Old Vine and Mountain States, because Colorado West, unlike the insurers, did not have a duty to defend. So therefore, we believe we have the right to explore the reasonableness of those settlements, and only Mr. Levine, who handled those settlements, who negotiated those settlements, knows what role late notice factored into his decision to settle for what he did.
Does that give you
one last question?
Yes, sir.
The record is also undisputed that from the time policies were turned over to Mr. Dietrich, about 9 months elapsed before Mr. Levine gave notice to Mountain States, correct?
That's what it appears to be, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Would the bailiff please add 3 minutes to the time remaining for the appellant's rebuttal? Or I'll just keep track of it. Okay. You have a little over 6 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'll address the cross appeal issues first. Couple of points there. Mr. Arguello said that they're trying to be circumspect with respect to naming current counsel as non-parties in the case. But the fact of the matter is they didn't hesitate to name Mr. Dietrich as a non-party in this case before taking his deposition for essentially the same reasons. They're saying he didn't give notice when he should have done so. Colorado West has all the facts that it needs to know that is actually pertinent to its claim regarding whether we impacted the causation of damages by not giving notice earlier. In other words, they essentially know when policies were provided, even if they don't know specifically what policies were provided when, and they know when the tender letters were turned over to Mountain States and American Guarantee. They don't need to inquire into the reasons why counsel did not send those tender letters out until those points in time, what their reasoning was or what the analyses they were doing of the coverage issues or anything else that might have impacted the timing of the notice. And as Mr. Arguello said, they don't need to know what role we had in terms of providing notice. And in fact, I think Mr. Dietrich is pretty clear about that, that we were not charged as counsel dealing with coverage issues in terms of going out and looking for specific coverage under other policies.
Couldn't Mr. Dietrich explain why he didn't give notice to Mountain States or American Guarantee?
I don't recall. I think he was kind of ambiguous about that. He didn't really recall what it was. I think he just did not realize that the other policies
were out there at that point in time. In fact, he tendered notice to Colorado West, initially thinking that was the insurance company, and then getting the communications back, and then relying on them to go ahead and notify everybody that potentially would be on the risk at that point.
And did he testify that he turned all the policies over to your firm?
I don't recall whether he testified that he recalled doing that. I didn't think that was essentially his testimony. He didn't recall specifically giving the policies, but I think the record is fairly clear that the policies were transmitted to our law firm at some point.
And 9 months later, notice was given to Mountain State, or 7 months later.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if you want to explain the reasons why, that'll open up the privilege, but so far, that's not going to the record, I take it.
That's correct.
Mr. Arguello makes a second point, well, honest, and I know you have other things to say. He says he also wants to take depositions regarding the settlement. And I'm not quite sure why that is different, why that puts it in a different light, but what do you say with respect to that argument? I mean, the settlement was paid, and the settlement was too low that they have the right to explore. That is approximate cause of the alleged damages?
They have a right to challenge the reasonableness of the settlement, I believe, under DC 10 case, just like an insurance company would be. But the fact of the matter is they don't need to inquire into our thought processes, our work product, our communications with our clients in order to be able to do that. Because what they get to challenge is the reasonableness of the damages. They don't need to talk to us to do that. They have plenty of other sources that they can get that information from. Most importantly, the old buying people. Ari Stutz and Mark Citrenbaum, for example, they were available for depositions. They were the principals of Old Vine. Old Vine's counsel, trial counsel in the underlying case, they would have been available to provide deposition testimony, just like Mr. Dietrich was. None of those other sources of information were taken advantage of, just like they could have talked to Christine Hayter, which was the trial counsel appointed by Mountain States just a few weeks before trial. Could have talked to her, find out what she had to say about it and why she was interested in getting the case settled. They being Colorado West, obviously has access to Mountain States' own attorney, Stacy Sheriff. She provided the affidavit that Colorado West relied on in its briefs as well. So there are plenty of other sources that would inform the issue of whether the damages that were determined by the arbiter in this case.
Okay, I understand. Let me ask one other question. You suggested earlier, and I think suggest now, that Colorado West could be liable for the amounts that the arbitrator ultimately found Malaga was liable for the breach of agreement. I don't quite follow that. Once your client accepted $250,000 as Mountain States contribution, I assume you gave them a release of all claims against Mountain States, correct?
That's correct.
So why is there any suggestion that Mountain States would have stepped up to provide the amount that the arbitrator awarded, given the fact that you already settled with them and given them a release? Where's the proximate causation for that unit damage caused by a lack of notice when Mountain States did finally come in and did accept the facts?
The proximate causation in terms of why you get to try to recover the entire amount against Colorado West?
Not just the pre-appearance damages.
Those were damages that were, we alleged, the direct result of having to settle the claims with Old Vine at the point in time that we did. And there is, it ought to be up to the jury to decide whether, in fact, Mountain States or perhaps American Guarantee at some point in time would have contributed additional money to settle at an earlier point in time had they received notice.
Mountain States came in, offered $250,000, your client, Ovine accepted the total. Your client accepted the $250,000. You gave a release to Mountain States. At that point, why is there any suggestion that Mountain States could have been liable for the amount that the arbitrator awarded? I take it sometime later.
I see.
It's okay. Please answer the question.
So the question is, is there any reasonable suggestion that Mountain States would have paid anything more than the $250,000, any part of the additional damages awarded? It's possible, but the fact is that those are damages that were incurred. They don't have to be covered damages in order to recover them against Colorado West. Those were damages that an arbiter awarded as a result of the claims between Old Vine, by Old Vine against Malaga. And because of Colorado West's failure to give notice, in a more timely matter, we alleged that we were required to go ahead and try to settle those claims and mitigate the risk to our clients because of that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, got another minute.
No, you're already
that's overtime.
That's a deficit.
Okay.
It's like extra time in soccer.
Would you like me to sit down now? Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle. We appreciate the arguments of all counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.